Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. And with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themacguffinman.com. Keep up on our most recent podcasts. Our last one was about The Long Goodbye. Before that was The Rules of the Game. M before that, Phantom Thread, Little Women, Parasite, and Uncut Gems before that. You can also buy a book I wrote, should you be so inclined. It's called Content About Content. My name is Alex Stevenson. You can purchase it on Amazon. It's a collection of essays about topics like Shia LaBeouf, The Social Network, and Pulp Fiction, Run DMC, Eminem, a variety of other topics, Zooey Deschanel, Pink, all these things. But yeah, anyway, start the episode. James.
Yes, Alex.
Here we are, talking about performance film. I have to change the intro ever so slightly.
Talking about Bo Burnham's Make Happy.
Mm-hmm.
His stand-up special.
Mm-hmm.
Some fun music in there, too, which isn't crazy for a stand-up special. But we don't do a lot of stand-up specials, and I think we both watch and enjoy stand-up specials, but I think for even the ones that we really like, that we think are interesting, sometimes there's not a lot of stuff to say about a stand-up special. It's kind of just saying which jokes you liked and which jokes you didn't like as much. So it kind of took a really creative version of a stand-up special for us to want to talk about it. And that's what this is, right? We haven't done anything else like this, I don't think.
No, we haven't. Usually, like, when we talk about something that, like, the nearest comparison point for something that we've talked about along the lines of Make Happy would be Popstar, where we used it as a way to talk about everything Lonely Island has ever done. But, like, but yeah, even that was sort of building off the movie, and we certainly mentioned Bo Burnham's specials when we did Eighth Grade, but I mean, this is the first podcast we've done on not a film in years and years and years. So yeah, it is a bit of a departure for us. But going back to what you were saying, like, yeah, most stand-up specials just don't have a lot to talk about. I think part of the reason we can do a podcast on this special is that I don't always feel comfortable calling it a stand-up special. I feel like it's more just a performance that's recorded, and since he's tells jokes, like, we feel like we're supposed to call it a stand-up special, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of where I am with it, because if this was something that we classified as a stand-up special, we wouldn't be doing a podcast on it, you know what I mean? And it's all those things that you're talking about where it's just, there's, like, we recognize it as a stand-up special because it starts with pre-filmed intro, and then person walks on the stage and picks up a mic and tells a joke, you know? But, like, basically, and it plays with that form in general, but I just don't view it as a stand-up special. And I view it as a live performance that has been recorded, and also uses a lot of the elements of the recorded medium to its benefit. So yeah, and part of the reason that I love it so much and what I wanted to talk about it is because it's very difficult to talk about. And I think even, like, Bo Burnham has difficulty talking about it when he was giving interviews about it. And it's just, I think we're going to say a lot of conflicting ideas throughout this podcast, because I think this whole special is conflicting ideas. And Bo Burnham's very open about that. And that's exactly why I love it, and why it's worth talking about, because, you know, you don't totally understand it, you know?
Yeah, and I've sort of read some of his feelings about it lately in researching for this podcast, but even before that, in my notes section, I just have an area called contradictions, which are all the things that, you know, kind of double back on themselves or contradict something from earlier. And somehow it's not a bad thing. I don't think it hurts it, and, you know, we'll kind of dig into more of the specific emotions, but this special, this product, this content, this
no, definitely not, definitely not content. It never ever call it that.
No, he wants me to call it that.
Oh no, I'm gonna have an emotional breakdown if you say it one more time. So let's keep it moving.
No, it's clearly made by somebody who has conflicted feelings about what they're doing, mm-hmm. and about who they are, and about the way people see them, and about the way that they present themselves, and the way that you know, the audience is presenting itself to each other, you know, just in pop culture in general. There's just a lot of ideas here, and it's hard to nail down a thesis statement, even though it's clear that he's passionate and has a lot of opinion. It's just that there are so many, and it just feels like I think that this is so well put together, but it feels like he kind of just had to stop at a point and could have tinkered with it forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's true of a lot of things, but it doesn't, I don't know. I just don't get the sense that it was a perfect summation of what he was feeling at any given moment, because it does bounce around so much. But I think it's so wildly effective that that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to go back to what you were saying, it's not always clear what it's about. This is part of the hypocrisy of it. At one point he says, what's the show about? The show is about performance, you know. And I think that is as close to a thesis statement as you're gonna get. But as we've discussed, he's constantly undermining that idea, you know, like or not undermining it, but sort of like asking further questions about it, even though he explicitly says the show's about performance. It's also about like not wanting to perform and being afraid of performing while actively performing. And I think the thing that is a part of that one of the hypocrisies of the special is that he's doing all, he is performing and has conflicted feelings about it. And those sort of the things where he's sort of jumping around a little bit more, and the more bits, I guess we could call them, than sort of something where he's monologuing about not, you know, the panic attacks he had on his previous tour, for the last song. He does still feel this need to entertain the people that have paid, I don't know what they paid to get into that theater, but you know, I've been to a comedy show of that with that number of people present, and I know it's you know, you want to get some sort of entertainment out of it, and he's open about that as well. So it's like, it's him being conflicted with performing and wanting to say something that he feels is the truth to him, but also recognizing the construction of the medium, in that 1,500, 2,000 people, however many people are there, have paid money to see him. And, you know, in the first song, he says something along the lines of, I hope you get more out of this than I do. And, but it's also, he's saying that as a way that's sort of like a question. He doesn't know that that's the case, you know? And I think there are large portions of this show where it's pretty clear the audience doesn't really know how to react, specifically in the last song, which if it hasn't already become clear, will become extremely clear, is the obvious highlight of the show to me. But I don't know how I would have felt about it seeing it in person. You know, I think I would have been one of those people that's like, what is happening? And I don't know what to do. And the way that is offset to make sure that people still enjoy their night is to give them little bits about him making a sandwich while stoned, you know. So that's sort of the yin and yang of the Bo Burnham special, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's important to flag something you said about him drawing attention to the construction of it, because this is someone who kind of got famous on YouTube, kind of just skipped the grinding it out doing stand-up part of your career. Mm-hmm. And not to say that he, you know, didn't work hard at the start of his career, because I think they did, but that's something else that kind of separates it from other specials. You know, he has specials like this and some that are probably more straightforward than this when comparing it to what you typically think of when you think of a stand-up special. But you know, just the fact that he kind of found his way on the internet, on YouTube, in a situation where you have complete control. You know, you film something, And if you don't like the take, you just redo it, or you edit something, or you cut some clips together, or you can put effects on things. And, you know, you're really so in control of that, because until it's absolutely perfect, you just don't release it, which is not the case when you're doing a live stand-up performance. And it's funny that it's so, he'll point this out, that everything's planned out to the gesture. It's so incredibly tight in so many ways, and just because I've watched this many times, you can see the one or two tiny slip-ups, but they're so minor, and they don't negatively impact it. But just the lighting and the music cues and the smoke hisses from industrial piping and sound effects, like, to go from that world, as I said, where you're so in control of everything, and then to do this, where, you know, you're in control in the fact that you've designed it, but you have no room to really play around. Like, it's so tightly scripted and so tightly performed that I think that's one thing that's amazing from a performance standpoint. But, you know, just because the degree of difficulty is tough, but I think it's a super interesting way to deal with a lot of these things that he talks about. Like performance and kind of being a victim of your own success and having people's expectations. Like, once this starts, he is just completely at the mercy of his old ideas and what the audience is going to think of them. He can't really just pull the chute and change his plan because people are reacting a certain way. Like, he has to stick to it. And I find that so impressive, that just the level of confidence that takes, I'm sure, is amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, what you're saying is he can't sort of like slide into crowd work and pick out somebody in the front row, aside from this crowd work bit. But
that is so highly staged again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So scripted, yeah.
But yeah, you can't just like spot somebody with a stupid hat in the front row and then just start riffing on them for a bit, because that's just sort of not how the show's designed. And when you're talking about how, when he initially got famous, you know, he's like 16, this is like 2006, and he wasn't getting famous initially from like highly edited videos. And there aren't a lot of like Bo Burnham music videos that exist. I can think of two, and there might be more, but that are like proper music videos. Most of them are one take, like him in his bedroom playing a funny song on a piano or a guitar. And of course he can do multiple takes, but he has always been very, very interested in performance just as a concept, and like theatrical performance. And you really get the feeling that he was just a drama class kid, you know, and was just very, very interested in theatrical performance. And like you said, there's just so much of that present in the show. It's that, like, it starts and it just keeps going, apart from a couple moments where people yell things at him. You know, it's just, there's no room for deviations from the script, because your lighting guy and your sound guy will get confused and not be able to do it. And you just go to the listening to him talk about how they were sort of coming up with the lighting cues. They basically rented a performance space, like a garage essentially, and worked out the lighting cues and sound cues before he went on tour. And then they had a general idea of what they were doing, but they only played theaters that could support the specific show that they were doing. And so they also worked on the timing of those cues throughout the tour, to the point where these were the last two shows of the tour that were filmed for this special. I think he did do a few more afterwards, like as a secondary tour, but yeah, they used the tour to workshop it, because there's no way that you can go down to like the Laugh Factory and try out these bits, you know. So it's that's something that sort of sets it apart, and makes it, I think, more, helps add to the performance element, because even musical comedy, I think, is just hard to try out bits, you know, even without the industrial canons and all these things. It's just, I would imagine it's trickier to workshop that, like jokes, you know?
Yeah, and it takes such a level of commitment, like improv or something. Like, you just can't half-ass it. Whereas in comedy, if you're kind of just trying to be a cool comedian, you can kind of say that joke sucked and kind of kind of slip in and out of the character that you might be playing as, you know, like a, an exaggerated version of yourself, but with musical comedy performance like that, like, you really have to be that character or whatever angle you're trying to play in that particular song, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's harder to, like, noodle around, you know? Like, nobody wants the musical comedy equivalent of The Grateful Dead, you know? Like, especially when they've shown up to, like, a comedy club, you know? Comedic noodling is just unpopular in general, unless you're Dave Chappelle. But
right. I think the thing about it being as like, I think you're absolutely right that it would take all of this work and to get it that tight and to have it kind of more or less perfect by the end of it. But one, and again, that's very impressive from a performance aspect, but I think it ties in so well with the things that he's talking about. You know, he's kind of when he talks about being a public figure and, you know, trying to be happy and try to bring other people happiness. You know, you kind of get that Frankenstein's monster kind of thing. Like, you've created something and now you have to deal with it. And that's how I think of this whole special. Like, the big sets that surround him are bigger than a normal comedy show. And then all these different uses of disembodied voices and other characters that are all planned out already. Like, you get this sense that there is this imposing box that he's put himself in, and that, you know, within the frame of this special, and for an hour, you kind of just watch him, like, fight back and, you know, respond to these voices and talk to the piping and react to the musical cues. And again, the performance of it is amazing, but when you look at it in the meta way of the things that he is talking about through this special, it's so interesting that he has managed to work that into the mise-en-scène and the production design and the set design or whatever it would be called in comedy. But it's such an interesting example of, you know, I find myself talking about it more like we talk about films, because this is just so much more than a guy on stage doing things. And I don't mean that negatively. I happen to love so much stand-up comedy a lot. But for him to elevate this art form in this way, I think is just so deeply impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm going back to what you were talking about sort of once you're on stage, you're painted into the or sort of painted into a corner from your own past or your own past successes. And, you know, the plant on stage at the beginning of the show, the guy sitting on the stool is dressed and sitting like Bo Burnham sits at the beginning of his previous special, What, you know? Yeah. And like the opening shot of What is like super impressive. And it's obvious that they shot it without an audience and then just cut it into the show later. And I think that's sort of exactly what you're talking about. But even for Make Happy, they're just like, all right, we assume that most of the people here have seen What, and that's probably the most impressive part of What is the intro. So they'll know this outfit and assume it's Bo. I agree. And I think that's, all of these things are sort of helped to elevate it. And what you're talking about with, you know, talking about this more like it's a film than most comedy specials would be, you know, there's a lot in this that is shot without an audience and that is cut into the live show. Basically anytime you see a camera on a dolly and it's not shooting the audience, you get it really clearly in the country song where the dolly is like right at the front of the stage, a low angle shot of Bo while he's doing the chorus specifically. And you get this really good look at the lights that are changing. That like, there's just no way to get that shot while there's actually an audience there. Later in, I don't think I can handle this right now. As the piano kicks in, we get this dolly push into Bo on stage by himself. They couldn't shoot this with people in those seats because there would be a crane hitting people in the head and just concussing everybody. I wouldn't have picked this out if I didn't know it, but it certainly seems like a large portion of his monologue, when delivered in close up, where he's talking about like what is the show about performance, a large portion of that was shot without an audience the next day. And I think that just sort of speaks to the idea that you really want to get these things right. And he knows that this is a show for somebody he's performing on stage for the people that are in the seats, but he's also recording it for the people like us at home, you know, and there are elements of it that, again, that are just sort of, he's not going to make it so clear that it's an obvious lie, you know, like I think a lot of people watch these shows without noticing these shots are cut in from outside of the performance, but it plays into the idea that the performance is a lie, you know, when he's yelling, "I'm not honest for a second up here," you know, like all these things. And it all just melts together into this one beautiful, weird thing that is truly unique, I think.
Yeah, I think it's important that he is drawing attention to, because you're right, I think sometimes it's not as obvious that, you know, he's kind of taking a few shortcuts to make the Netflix product really good, mm-hmm. or as good as possible. But there's definitely times where he just does draw attention to the facade of what he's doing. And I think he, you know, he's very explicit about questioning celebrities and questioning pop culture and mass consumption of pop culture. And yeah, even something like you said, as simple as people cheering for this person because they assume it's Bo, and then him getting kicked off stage right away. You know, it's just this immediate reset of a totally natural audience thing to do, just to go nuts when you see the person you believe you're there to see, but they haven't done anything. You don't really know it's them. Where are these super positive feelings coming from? And mm-hmm. kind of have you rethink it right away when he just kicks that person off and starts into a very silly song.
Yeah.
That and then even the song with all the call and response, it's you know, it's so quickly breaking down the typical audience performer dynamic, you know, just don't be Pavlovian here. I really want your opinions.
Yeah.
Things like that. And that happens throughout songs where there are just things that have been ingrained in culture about what you're supposed to do at a live show. And you just do a call and response and you say, yeah, and you cheer at these times. And it just seems like those are somewhat innocent examples of a cult of personality, or, you know, celebrity culture, that, you know, just doing a call and response, yeah, okay, whatever, it's kind of meaningless. But it just seems as though it's his goal to look at these as microcosms of other things that doing what you're told, or just cheering along with what is deemed popular, or just going with the crowd, that can have negative effects. And he kind of hones in on mental health is the negative effects, but you know, it's not hard to see that you could draw the line to something else, you know, maybe even worse than that.
Yeah, well, and I think going to the Pavlovian thing that you mentioned, like even before Bo says anything in the special, that intro voice, it's like once that song begins, it's like entertainers are here to control you, yada yada yada. The last thing it says before the song really kicks in is, and never makes, like, don't do what entertainers tell you, and never make some fucking noise. And the audience responds by cheering loudly, you know. And it's just like,
you hear, make some fucking noise, even if there's a couple words in the middle that totally contradict it.
And it's also like the way the voice is rising when he's saying no noise, like all of these things. And one of the best parts about this special, like, is just the way that I think Burnham toys with the idea of superiority over the audience, and simultaneously telling dumb jokes, but in a way that are supposed to make the audience feel stupid, you know, like there's just this constant, like, I'm better than the audience vibe. But he's also I don't know, some of the jokes he's telling are very stupid, you know, and it's just, I love it. And I mean, I always love when comedians make fun of their audience, but this is like especially wonderful to me. Yeah.
Yeah, and it does, it's so tough, because, and again, here's another contradiction, so I'll flag it before.
We can flag this whole podcast, so we can pre-flag.
That's a contradiction? Okay, yeah, that's yeah. Fair. I won't say flag anymore.
Yeah, this isn't going to have like a good winger speech at the end. We're not going to wrap this one up.
He does seem to have more disdain than his audience for his audience than Anthony Jeselnik, which is something. But also, yes, an incredible amount of like love and respect and like a genuine confidence that they can do better, which is such an odd thing to say about a stand-up special, but it just, it does seem like he just has high expectations for people, and not in an arrogant way, but just like that you guys should have self-respect because that should make you happier. And yeah, it's like so much of this stuff, it's super heavy at times and then gets played really successfully for laughs at times, and it's just the dexterity with which he bounces between those two ideas and makes you laugh as the ball bounces both ways is what's has to be one of the things that I find most enjoyable about this.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I'm, you know, the part where he yells, "The show is a series of discrete bits, that one's over," like it's so funny and so stupid, but like, and he's just taking this position of not just authority, but like the authority, like, "I'm better than you, and you know, I'm the best in this room." But then he's also just mixing in the, like, the Israel Palestine joke in the first song is just like, so he's just like, "I don't know, man." You know, so he sort of bounces between the idea of being the only person that knows what's happening and being just like everybody else and having no real idea how to comment on something. And I think the other thing that's tied into that is the way that, and we certainly talked about this a lot with Lonely Island, is the way that he toys with the concept of masculinity, you know, and just sort of, and I think that always goes hand in hand with somebody who is like, aggressively being like, "I am better than you." And it just feels like a very man, like
macho. Yeah.
Yeah. Stereotypical, male sort of tendency. And I, tied to that, I just love the way that he will toy with standard constructions of masculinity. Like, I think it's worth noting that one of the biggest cheers he gets in any of the songs is when he says, "You might think your dick is a gift, I promise it's not." Like, that's one of my favorite lines in this whole special, and I think it's so funny and so like perfectly undermining just maleness, and yeah. And I think that runs through a lot of songs, but most specifically, that love song specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, and pretty well in the country song. And you and I have broken a rule and talked about this a little bit because we didn't know we would podcast about it. I think I like it a bit more than you do, but that's another example where he does that
very well. For sure. And I think our difference on the country song is I just think that, like, I could imagine a world where somebody else makes that country song, like that country comedy song, and it makes me laugh as hard, where I don't think anybody could do something like Kill Yourself. Like, that's specifically Bo Burnham to me, and can't handle this right now is specifically Bo Burnham. Whereas you could, like, if the Lonely Island came out with country song tomorrow, you'd be like, "Yeah, that makes sense. Everything about this checks out." You know, even like the Scarecrow bit is like so wonderfully like Lonely Island silly, you know?
I will grant you all of that. I think that in the past, like, that the country music joke has just been like, it's about getting dumped in a truck and your dog, you know, you've heard that joke a million times. And you know, it's not as though there isn't a couple elements of that here, but the Bo Burnham-y twist, and I can see how this would be a Lonely Island thing as well, but I think more Bo is just like, the audience, you should have more respect than this. You should see through this. One thing I'll point out while we're on this song is when he starts off, but it's pretty early on, he says rural noun, simple adjective. That is a pretty good joke, simple adjective. But there's a moment, like, it gets a bigger laugh than it should, you know, in my opinion. And I think it's one of those things, you can hear it in certain specials and, you know, different kinds of performances, but it's the first joke, and I think everyone is sort of unsettled by how good he's, like, how well he's performing this country. Like, he's just a good singer, and is, like, and, you know, like all good musical comedians, like Weird Al, or, you know, pick whoever you want, is, and Lonely Island, they're actually really good musicians. this comes from an understanding and sometimes deep love of this music. And so I always hear that bigger laugh is a bit of kind of nervous laughter getting out. Like, it's just a bit of this first relief where they get to kind of breathe a little bit about what's happening.
Yeah, for sure.
And then sorry, the fuckers get the keychain they wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, and I mean, I think like I sort of put that in the hip hop song really like hand in hand. I certainly like country song better than the hip hop song, but I think they're sort of similar in that like I could see somebody else doing them, you know. And I do right.
Like beat fetishism one.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like I love the intro. I am not one of you. I'm not a human being. Like that's. I feel like that could be Amigos song, like that, yeah. That like a hook of Amigos song. And this comes out in 2016, so it's right around when Migos is really starting to get popular. So I think that's especially funny. But yeah, it's just sort of like that seems like that song should be a joke for me. And it's just sort of, I don't know, it's a bit more one note. But again, I'm picking nits here. I love this whole thing. You know, like I'm not. I'm saying I don't love it as much as the other things that I love more than almost anything else in the world, you know? Like,
yeah, I know. Even just the last time watching it, I always just kind of waiting, like, I always kind of expect once that song to start to just wait for it to be over, but I actually like his dance a lot.
Oh, yeah, the teapot dance? It's so funny.
And the line, is there a sick beat back there?
Oh, also. Yeah, of course. Lucky for him, there was. It's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And talking about like throwing to these songs, I did very much appreciate his quick diss of Bruce Springsteen right before he does the country song. I love that.
The unassailable Bruce Springsteen.
Exactly. Nobody talks shit about the boss. It's nice to get some sort of conflicting opinion out there.
Yeah. Unexpected.
Yeah. Hard left. Smacks the shit out of the boss.
Another hard left, and you know, we kind of opened this with saying we can't really just do stand-up special episodes because it's just about talking about jokes we like, but here's an example of that. And it came to mind because we were talking about things we don't like as much, the bit when he's at the urinal.
Mm-hmm.
When he says this bit is over, I'm not talking into his dick now.
I didn't rip his dick off and I'm now not talking into it.
Yeah. Again, just some of those things we were talking about, like that joke is just kind of out of gas at that point and such a quick transition. And again, just sort of one more thing where he plays with the artifice of it, where that didn't need to be said, but it's these big tonal shifts and these big mood swings that you know, totally speak to that contradictory nature of this. And just, yeah, if we're going to say the thesis is about performance, which he claims it is, which I think is right, obviously.
Yeah. I think he reads an abstract for this special at one point, you know, before he does Can't Handle This. Like, it's, you know, if this could be perceived as like a thesis, or sorry, like a PhD that he's defending, I think the abstract is when he's like down on one knee before he does his Kanye song. But.
Yeah, but it's, I think that what I said about the country music song is that it just, he just wants people, and in this special overall, he wants people to like themselves enough to be critical of what they put into their brains.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that finds itself over and over in this idea of him constantly reflecting in real time about what he's doing. You know, like I didn't rip his dick off. Like it's a funny, silly joke, but it's also totally, taking this moment to keep on hitting the reset button. And I don't want to get too high-minded about it, but about just being critical about what you're watching and to kind of stop yourself from just slipping into, oh, okay, yeah, it's a comedy special. I know how this works. I laugh at these parts. I do a call and response here, whatever. It's just this, like, there's just constant calls to be more critical and to self-evaluate your reaction to these things. And like I said before, it works well and it makes good jokes, but you do get the sense that his most serious times that these are things he wants you to do in your life as a whole and not just on how you feel about Bo Burnham jokes.
Yeah, absolutely. He's pretty frequently just sort of talking about elements of culture that are very stupid and that we shouldn't support in any way. And
culture's over and we lost.
Yeah, it's the lip sync. It's the death of culture. And I think this special would have been recorded in a world before Lip Sync Battle as an actual television program. It's just when it's a, because he mentions it being the Tonight Show thing. So is what would have inspired that show for sure. So I guess culture died again. but yeah, of course I love that stuff. But and just going back to, I agree with everything you just said, but going back to that sort of idea of the tonal shifts that are happening pretty frequently and very fast, you know, you just sort of feel, I'm tying this into the filmmaking constructions, the way that him and his team are using that to make it sort of a more engaging special. You know, you go to the end of the intro song where he's like, you ready to get the show started? And he's just like doing laps of the stage, like, and just air punching things. And it's like this really like faux, I'm being energetic sort of thing. And it's not really especially funny. It's just sort of, he's doing something. He's just trying to be as energetic as possible to like sort of start the show with a big amount of energy, just because of the way the song's building and all that. And that part is cut really fast. It's like he runs to the front, cut, runs to the back, cut, couple more cuts. And then it's just, and then we get that light switch, we get another camera cut, and he just bounces into that joke about being at the non-joke, I guess, about being at the dentist. And as soon as he starts, that light changes and he starts falling into like stand up for the first part of the special, or the first time in the special, the way that it's shot and edited immediately becomes just like every other stand up special. It's just like a camera just panning with his body as he walks, you know, and he tells this joke, because it's now, we are now in stand up territory. The concert is over and we're telling a joke, you know. And I that's the most pronounced time when that specific thing happens, but it does happen a handful of times throughout the special, because, you know, the structure of this is pretty much song, couple of jokes, another song or a bit, couple of jokes, you know, and just rinse and repeat, basically.
Yeah, but he just manages to fit so much in here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And just I think because I've watched all his specials, and I just think that the thing that really, he's always funny. I don't love any of his other specials other than this. But there's element, you can see all of it. Like, you can see the future, you know, like having seen Make Happy, you can see where it comes out of in these specials. And there's always, you know, I think I love half of what, you know what I mean? And, but you can just sort of see the things building to Make Happy. And the thing that's the most impressive about Make Happy is he sort of he got to the point where he sort of like slowed down just enough, you know, like the pace of Make Happy is just right. And I think it's Words are just too fast, and they're too fast because he's so goddamn young, you know, like I don't even view that as a critique of him as an artist. And I think that most of the things I don't like about What and Words are very youth based things, you know? And I just sort of think, like, even though he's only 25 when he's making Make Happy, it's like he has sort of become an adult, you know? And you can really feel that in the pace. Like, it's still fast paced because he moves at a speed, you know, he moves at a Bo Burnham speed, and Bo Burnham is a very fast paced human being. And, but it is sort of like he calmed down just enough to have Make Happy be like this perfect, beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree, because in what's the one where he does the poetry reading, right?
He does do poetry, and he's got like the chimes next to him.
Yeah, and he does it so quickly, and, you know, on paper that seems like something I would love, like the poetry stuff, the rhymes, comedy stuff. Like, it's almost musical, like a ton of musical comedy stuff. And I watch it, and I'm like, that is super impressive, and I'm done with it. It's, you know, it's like hearing a really great metal guitar solo for me, who's someone who just doesn't like metal. I'm like, wow, that is technically very impressive, and I could never do that. And I don't know that I need to hear that again anytime soon.
Yeah.
Where this one, he knows, like, I'm sure he could still perform a bunch of those poems very quickly, and they're funny. You know, they're written as good comedy. I'm not saying that they're bad, but it's just a little too much. And yeah, you're right. Like I get it, but you have the energy and the memory, and that's amazing. But sometimes the most you can do isn't the best you can do, and this just feels like he found. I mean, if there's a better happy medium that he has in his future, then I'm super excited about that too. But yeah. This does feel like he has just honed some skills that were kind of spraying a bit wildly. And yeah, this one is still so scripted and still so tight in so many senses, but it doesn't feel like it has that kind of virtuoso for virtuosity's sake.
Yeah, exactly. And again, what he's doing, he's 22, you know, and I think that's just something that I don't think we can mention enough, you know, and we also happen to be pretty low energy humans in general, you and I. So it's like, I don't think we have a lot of similarities to Bo Burnham with the pace with which we attack things in general. So that's part of it as well. Yeah. But I don't know.
Well, on the topic of his age, we haven't really talked about that part of it in this, the sort of specific generational things about him. You know, he talks about how he didn't want to do a show about performing because no one could relate to it who's not a performer, but that everybody's a performer. And there are elements of that that would be true about someone who was born in 1965, but it just seems that with his kind of entertainment history and just how old he is and kind of our generation as well, that it does present some kind of modern problems, and that this, you know, wanting to be like a celebrity is can be problematic throughout history, but it's the social media element that is timely to this one.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the thing that sort of makes Burnham more critical, I think, about these things and openly critical is that it's like he's lived a social media experience way faster than a normal person does, because he got like actually famous off of the internet. So it's like everything that like you, a regular person after 8 years of like Instagram use, might be like, oh, what did I do any of this for? But he was like a comet that burned faster than everything else, you know? So it's like he got to that point faster than everybody else. And I think in general, this special feels like I guess I'm defining a quarter life crisis, but somebody who is 25 and going through a midlife crisis, you know, it's sort of like, what is this world? What am I doing here? Or what are any of us doing here? And I think the social media aspect is, I don't think he's ever really specifically talking about social media like explicitly, but he's talking about performance and how we're all performing. And I think that's true in a world pre-social media as well. You know, like you're sort of your personality is different depending on the situation that you're in. Like this will shock nobody who's listening to this podcast. This is not how you and I have every one of our conversations, you know, like with a Word document of notes in front of us, you know, like we're going
to for more than 6 minutes at a time without saying something horrible to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the only times we're nice to each other is when we are recording our conversation.
Sometimes I say, I agree with you, Alex.
I mean, also, you call me Alex, you know, like that's different, you know, on its own. But yeah, and I think the easy tie-in is social media in general, and specifically because you're now performing for a faceless audience, that I think is a good, really good moment in this special is when Bo is talking about how he fears the audience, and we get a cut to the audience where they're still in the shadows, right? And I saw an interview with him where he's like, in comedy specials, the audience is always smiling and well lit. To me, they're a mob, faceless black entity. They're intimidating, strange, and creepy. And that's sort of what he's talking about there. And I think that's what the implication is, that social media is you're performing to these people, but why do you care about these people? They're just shadows in the darkness, or silhouettes in the darkness. And I think that's the element of outward performance that he's talking about, you know, and it's certainly interesting, you know, and especially given his age and life experience. You know, he's one of very few people who have had that specific life experience, you know, not just being YouTube famous, but being one of the first people who becomes YouTube famous, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's just, he was like a, one of the first cowboys in the Wild West, you know, and it's just, it's kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny to talk about his life because we talk, you know, as you said, he was famous on YouTube, kind of one of the kind of guinea pigs of it, you know, just because one of the early adopters, I guess, to do it that well. And he's so frank about some of his feelings, and he's, you know, very vulnerable. You know, he refers to himself as a skinny kid with steadily declining mental. Like, there are some, I know it's funny, but, you know, there's these extreme moments of honesty and vulnerability, but there's nothing biographical in this. And no. It strikes me like it's so, yeah, he really puts himself out there in certain ways, but and part of it is that his comedy is kind of absurd, but like he makes a point about, you know, cool, this actually happened, you know. It's, if you just watched his specials, you would know nothing about his life. Like, you would guess he was American and, you know, not super poor or super rich, but you kind of don't know anything about him. And it only kind of struck me recently that there is, you know, he really lays it out to bear, but in stand up, you know, we get these Marc Maron, you know, like there's so many types who are so explicit about my father, my boyfriend, my kid, this is what they think of me kind of thing. And for this one to be so blunt about issues like mental health and, you know, self-respect and these kind of very personal issues, there's very little personal stuff about Bo's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you are correct. And, I think the thing that, he does sort of talk, the element that he talked about a lot in interviews and even when he was promoting Eighth Grade as to why he's made a movie instead of making another special is, and this is very prevalent and Can't Handle This right now, is the, on the tour for What, he would start having onstage panic attacks, you know, and I think he said he's in an interview around the time of Eighth Grade's release, he's had like 12 panic attacks, 11 of which happened on stage during the What tour. And that's what Can't Handle This is about. That's why all of us talking about fear in the audience happens in that. And I think it's just because even after that, he still goes back and performs. He does another special, you know, and he's also talked about he took more steps to sort of help his own mental health in between these two specials. So that's part of what allows him to perform without having panic attacks at this point. But the just sort of that dichotomy of talking about fear in the audience and fear in the audience in a way that was so intense that he would have panic attacks about it on stage while performing to the audience in his previous tour is, I think that's kind of all the personal information that you need to, that's more personal information than most performers give you ever. And it might just be one fact, but it's like, it counts for a lot, I think, as far as I'm concerned, you know? And I think that's sort of why the audience has a hard time navigating that last bit, even though he's not specifically saying on my previous tour, I had panic attacks on stage, you know, he's going through all of the thoughts that he would have had theoretically would have had after this tour and how he's thinking about, can I do another tour? How I've got to write songs, all these things. And he sort of gets to this point where he's writing a song that is his closer about how he can't handle performing on stage. And he hasn't performed on stage again, you know, like it's this really interesting thing. And, interesting is the wrong word, but like I was listening to an interview with him around when Make Happy came out, and he talks about how he's like, the closer for the special is me talking about how I need to stop doing stand-up And then he says, and I actually fucking did stop doing these performances. And I think that's sort of the real button on this whole thing, is that he made a song about not being able to perform, or not being conflicted about performing, and then actually stopped performing. And my understanding is he has written songs and just hasn't done a tour, but still it is it's kind of interesting. And just that whole process he's going through with the audience throughout the special, and then building to the closer, where he's starting to actively say, well, he says, my biggest problem's you, you know, and that's when we get that cut to the silhouette audience. It's just all of these things coming together, and it's just really interesting. And you're right that there's no real specific, I'm from Massachusetts, you know, and in Massachusetts, this is how we do things. There's none of that, you know, like, but I do think you get a lot of personality through the way that he talks to the audience, the way he feels conflicted about how he talks to the audience, and that sort of the relationship between being angry at the audience and then telling the dumbest joke imaginable to the audience, you know, like just sort of undermining his own intelligence. I don't know. I think I'm not really making sense, but I think that's kind of the point, you know, like it's kind of what he's going for. It's just, he's afraid of the audience, basically, but yeah, he still needs them. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he speaks about celebrities at other points in this. I think when he talks about him, his role as just somebody else in the service industry, like if I stop entertaining you, you can kick me to the curb.
Yeah.
I think there's this attempt to, I don't know if dehumanize is the right word, but he's just taken with what we've been saying, and taking with that last quote I brought up, like, don't worry about me as a person. Like, don't worry about my family or my parents or spouse or children are going to do if my career goes poorly. Like, I'm not your problem. I people like me, entertainers, are here to give you what, you know, to entertain you. And if don't fall in love with who they are and their personality and get guilty and be on the hook for kind of these greater things. Like, these people aren't your friends. And I don't mean that in a way that they mean you poorly, but it's an economic exchange, right? It's, you know, he says, like, it kicked me to the curb as soon as I stop entertaining you.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, in a way that seems so cold, but in a way it's so, sincere. You know, you're not his friend. He's not your friend. Mm-hmm. He seems to wish you well. if you confuse the nature of this relationship, it's going to lead to bad things.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the thing we have to talk about is my favorite single edit in this special.
Because takes the sweater off for continuity error.
Well, yeah, that joke is so, for me, it's not even funny to me, you know, because I could sort of see what's coming, you know, like it's the one time in the special I was ahead of him. But it's in that same bit that we're talking about. It's earlier than the shot of the silhouette of the audience, but it's before he launches into his Kanye song, and he says, I know very little about anything, but what I do know is that if you can live your life without an audience. And then there's a hard cut to his point of view looking out at the audience, and it's just like, and then it comes back to Bo, and he says, you should do it. And the first time I saw this special, I was like aghast. That edit is so like hard, like and it's just an edit you would never see in anything like this. And there just aren't point of view shots from live stage shows or recordings of live stage shows, and it's also just absolutely undermining everything he's saying. And it's also like it's so in your face but also subtle, because he's not specifically underlining why that shot is there, you know, like any intelligent person gets it. But like, it's just, and still every time I've watched the special probably 20 times now, every time that cut happens, it like, you could feel it, you know. And it's just, and I think that's, to go back to what you're saying about there's not, you know, explicit elements of his personality, I think that edit is all the personality that you need, you know, like he's a co-director of this special. I would imagine that once we're getting into the editing room, he's really controlling it, and the directing, his co-director handles a lot of the, you know, just making sure the cameras are doing what they're supposed to do while Bo is busy being on stage, you know, like I think that's sort of probably the division of duties there. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I think you could write a 1,000-page memoir and not tell me as much about yourself as that one edit tells me, you know, and it's just, it's incredible.
And so do you mean to take it as, if you can live your life without an audience, do it. And the fact that, does this mean he can't do it? The fact that he's thought about this idea and rejects it for like for his understanding of how things should go?
Certainly at this point, I think that's sort of what it's supposed to be. It's him dealing with, and then the song that he goes into is this conflicting, the whole song is built upon him combining these elements about him personally, like the skinny kid with the steadily declining mental health that we've mentioned, and then cutting them in with bits about Pringles cans and burritos that are just very funny and everybody would laugh at, you know? And it's just alternating between these two things. And then at the very end, he's just talking about how you can make it, say anything, make it funny, make it rhyme, whatever, just build it up and break it down one more time or whatever. And then he just goes back into the big finish, but it's still just this incredibly sad song, but people start cheering because the lights have changed and the piano comes back in again. And it's just all of these things just combining as one. And it's, I don't know, man, it's one of a kind. It's just, it's impossible.
It's okay, so I'll play to devil's avocado here.
Please, go for it.
Because we have said pretty much resoundingly positive things about this, which is not surprising to me because that's how I feel.
Yeah.
But so if we compare that song, the Kanye song, the Can't Handle This Right Now, the Burrito Jam, as it's popularly known, to the country song. So it seems like we're supposed to kind of listen to his country song, and you know, I've kind of stated how it's slightly different than other ones, but how that's a song that makes fun of stupid people for hearing a couple words and finding it meaningful and totally missing out on how simplistic it is, and that it's got the mandolin and it's got all these it's got the word truck, so they come in their own calls. Like, yeah. It's got all these signifiers, so you're supposed to feel a certain way about it, and then you're dumb for a result of it. So what is it that makes the audience who reacts pretty enthusiastically to his Kanye song different? Like, is it not just as manipulative?
100%. And I think he's open about that. Sorry, I cut off your question, but
no, yeah, no, you're getting to it anyway. But it's that the, you know, the rant is silly up front and smuggling in these ideas, because I think that even the way he talks about the Alabama crowds, like in the fucking moving candles,
yeah, of course.
It does seem like we're supposed to look down on them, whereas the Kanye music is just undeniably, I think we're supposed to understand that it's undeniably cool and that this manipulation is all right because it's a cool, popular artist to the right group of people that's already built in as Bo Burnham fans.
Okay. First of all, going back to the Alabama thing, it's a joke about the population of Alabama that then becomes a joke about how the audience is bigots for laughing at it, which is just some classic Burnham curveball right there. So the Kanye thing is, it's weird because Kanye is, so the country song, he specifically mentions Keith Urban as his model for that, or that's the one name that he drops, just like in Kill Yourself, he says Katy Perry's name. You know, he doesn't say Sarah Bareilles, even though he shouts out the song Brave, you know? And, but the country song, even though he says Keith Urban, it could be any number of artists, you know? It could be Blake Shelton. It could be, I'm out of country references, but, the Can't Handle This Right Now, Kanye is such a singular artist that it's you're right that it's cooler because it's one person, and it's obviously one person. And I think the fact that it's somebody who pretty much everybody would guess, like one of the most famous people alive now, who also probably has some real mental health issues. I think having Bo perform that song about those things while also wanting to make the audience happy. I don't know. It's hard to describe because like he's making fun of these things that he's poking fun at these quote unquote Kanye rants that were very famous at the time, because Kanye would do these amazing shows, one of which I was at the Yeezus tour. And I timed it when he started talking over the Runaway bit. He talked for 22 minutes until somebody literally walked up to him and said, we have a curfew in 5 minutes. And then he did a closer and then got off stage. And it's exactly what Bo Burnham's talking about. It's just sort of about things that are, there were things that are very important, like real world issues. I think the Grammys were coming up and he assumed he wasn't going to get nominated for any Grammys because I saw him in December. And he was upset about that. And it's just like, but it's exactly what Bo's talking about otherwise. But it's just like, it's this huge spectacle where this one person thinks that, you know what, fuck it, I can say whatever I want for 20 minutes. Like, that's sort of the mindset that this one person has. And I just think that it's a mindset that exactly one person on the earth has, and maybe now two if we're counting Bo Burnham, right? And yeah. But still, like, he still did a song after. He still made sure that we got the had some energy before we went out the door, even though he went full Kanye in the middle of it, you know? And I think that's the difference, right? Is that any number of people could do that stadium country song, like Boys Around Here or whatever. But Kanye is just specifically Kanye, and the song just sounds so much like Runaway specifically, you know, like, and Bo Burnham's very upfront about that. And I think that's the main difference, is that all these things that toying with, the celebrity or the way that we perceive Kanye, who is just one of the most well-known figures in the world, and even more so in 2016, probably, like, because he's still generally regarded as like the best musician in the world at that point. I think that's the big difference, is he's also toying not just with celebrity and audience, but one person's specific kind of celebrity that only one person had. Yeah,
and I think that if this came out at I don't think this moment ever existed, but if there was a time where it was Justin Timberlake was like head and shoulders above everybody and was undeniably at like the famous musician, just the nature of his music and what he talks about, couldn't just sub in a Justin Timberlake song.
No, exactly. It's so specific. Yeah, and also, like, again, just to briefly go back to Kanye, like, I think the Yeezus tour is probably 2013, you know, and this special is coming out in 2016. So it's like these quote unquote Kanye rants were so famous that like 3 years later, you can still do a bit to close your special with it, you know? And that's just sort of the type of fame and the type of singular celebrity that he's sort of playing with there to sort of talk about his own issues, Burnham's issues.
So what about the very ending then? Unless you have anything to say that we haven't covered yet, but I think we're near the end. Notes about things that you find funny? You want to do that?
I mean, we didn't talk about Kill Yourself anywhere near as much as we... I mean, again, it's just things that I find hilarious because I think those songs are absolute bullshit. So, like, he's absolutely playing to an audience of me, but it's just like, yeah. I think that the things that we haven't talked about that are in my notes are pretty self-evident. Like, Kill Yourself, If You Want Love, Straight White Male. These songs are just amazing. You know, like, and you don't need an explainer to know why they're great, you know?
I mean, for Kill Yourself is a different version of what we've been talking about, of just taking something that's looked at in this very specific way and sucking all the air out of it in such a funny way. And it's because the, like, maybe for me and maybe for everybody, the musical like the musical comedy person is Weird Al. And again, some people might have other examples, but and it's just he, I'm a fan of his, but that is so much more spoof, where this is satire, right? Like there's bits of spoof throughout what Bo does, no doubt, but it's so much of it's so much less look how goofy this famous person is than look how harmful this is. Yeah. And look at this thing that we all have kind of accepted, and let's find the darkest version of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's worth noting that you would know better than I about this, but I think Weird Al, like, if he released a song that an artist like actively didn't like that he was spoofing, he would just not ever perform that song again, right? Like, because Weird Al wants to be appreciated by the artists who he's making fun of, whereas there's like real anger in Bo Burnham in this special. And I think, like, if Katy Perry publicly complained about the song Kill Yourself, I think it would be the best thing that's ever happened to Bo Burnham. Like, he would love it so much. It would just make him so happy, you know?
And he'd go back to performing live.
Yeah, exactly. That would bring him back to the stage. And he would just do Kill Yourself over and over and over for an hour. But I do think we're doing that song a disservice if we don't mention the middle part of that song, where he's actually talking about how, you know, you should probably like look into getting therapy and all these things. And, you know, the first verse of the song is about how these songs are bullshit, and then gets into like an actual, like, frank discussion of mental health in the middle of a comedy song, you know, and that builds back to the joke, and it's the biggest moment of the song. And it's a return to the same joke from the first verse. And I think that's sort of this perfect encapsulation of what is happening in the best elements of this special is, he tells you what the joke is, makes all kinds of variations on this joke. There's, you know, legitimate, interesting thoughts hidden within it, both comedically and then also about his own personal life. But then it sort of brings it back to a joke, you know? And I think that's true of most of the songs, you know? And I think the ending of Can't Handle This Right Now is, pretty sad, you know, but I think pretty much every other song ends with, him going for the joke, you know? But not without ideas on their way there, you know.
Yeah, and the ending of Can't Handle This, it's the turn of phrase of I hope you're happy is, I think we've said microcosm or small example of or encapsulation of Bo Burnham a few times throughout this, but I think that's it for me. Like, I don't think you can... maybe that shot you've talked about of the audience, but like, it's hard for me to come up with a smaller, kind of more compact idea of what's happening in the special, because it's a phrase that we're supposed to understand as negatively, you know, it's the end of a fight. Well, you know, I hope you're happy, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't mean it at all. It's done in anger. And here he's kind of turned it to say, I hope you're happy, after having this very frank discussion of mental health. I hope that you can maybe take some of this, or, you know, just look within yourself and figure out a way to find more joy in your life. And, you know, it's these two ideas, and we've talked about 100 different contradictions that he's done throughout this. And to me, that is such a, it's such a good one, and it has such concision, and you do get a sense of some emotion while he's saying it, but you don't know if he's just exhausted from the song or if he's just happy to be done. Like, I find it still just so, so confounding and so interesting. And it's not quite the end of the special. And I think that it kind of keeps bouncing those ideas back and forth for two more little post credit sequences. But, I think it's a very powerful ending for a powerful hour.
Yeah, absolutely. And going into the, like, at that when the audience is applauding, I'm just like, when I finish watching the special, I'm very happy in that I know I've watched a piece of great art. I'm not happy, you know, like, it doesn't like, this isn't uplifting, you know, like, if I'm having a shitty day and want to feel better, I'm probably not going to put on Make Happy. But I think that's exactly what I love about it, is the idea that it's this form that is theoretically supposed to uplift you and you know, make your day a little bit better. And I think that's why the audience gives a standing ovation, because they think they're supposed to, because that's what that's what you do here. But that's just not how I feel. And certainly the last song, the what I guess is called Make Happy. I don't know what the titles of any of these songs are. But I love that song. I love the closing. And I think that sort of puts a real arc on something that is, again, a form that's really hard to have. Find a way to put an arc on, right? Like, go for it.
No, I think you're right that it's not one of those ones where I would say, yeah, if you had a shitty day, put this on. And parts of it are definitely going to make you laugh and give you some escapism. I don't think it's going to make you happy right when you're done, but it kind of gives you some tools to be happier in like a month, you know? Like, yeah. Like, care less about your social media feed, care less about celebrities, you know, be more critical of the cultural products you consume, and, you know, think for yourself once in a while. Mm-hmm. These are good pieces of advice, but they're just not. They're the vegetables that make you healthy instead of the candy that tastes good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love the last song.
Yeah, it's really good. It's again though, it's just tough when he's said, you know, I'm all, like he's saying, he's all alone now. He's talked about performing or not living your life in front of an audience if you can, and then there he still kind of doesn't escape it. You know, he's still playing music for us, and he's backstage, and he's, you know, there's no live theater audience, but mm-hmm. there's still us, and he still can't escape it. And then even one further step removed, we kind of have him off in the distance, blurry in this what seems to be positive domestic scene that's never fully explained, but I think that part we're supposed to kind of have a good feeling with. But there is still this idea that he doesn't just walk off stage and enjoy happiness in the privacy of his life, and we can't just trust some level of self-satisfaction, that there still is this performative element. You know, it's here's this person that he smiles with and a dog, and kind of these other indicators of what we're meant to believe are you know, this quote happy life, and he still has to show it to us. And that seems performative, and it seems, it just seems like him going backstage is this one step, and now he seems happy, but the song's sad. And then there's this other step where, oh, he looks happy there, but we don't really know what's going on, and why do we still have to see it if that's not important?
I think I have kind of a different take than you. I think the ending is like the very ending. I think that it does have a happy ending, like the last 5 seconds. <You know>? But, and I think the thing that I was talking about having an arc, right? Like the beginning of the special is him waking up alone in a hotel room, right? And the TV's on. And if you listen to the woman talking on the TV, she's talking about how her mother, you know, like, has gotten older or something along the lines. It's kind of hard to hear. You have to really try to hear it, but like, as she's gotten older, the things that were true about her as a younger person have just gotten more and more exaggerated. And I think that's worth noting, given that Bo Burnham is, again, 25, as he points out in the special. And certainly, like, you know, loudly or wondering out loud about certain elements of his own personality, you know, and the desire to perform in front of people. And, you know, he leaves this hotel, he's dressed as a clown, and he goes, walks through the world dressed as a clown, gets on stage, and then we see him leave the stage, right? But he takes the camera with him. And you sort of mentioned this when he's, you know, they do that sort of hidden cut where he walks backstage, and he's now in what I assume is sort of like a back shed where he writes his music at home, right? And they sort of disguise that cut. But the first thing he does once he sits down, he puts his notebook down, which is where the audience cuts out. Like, it's like a hard cut for the sound of the audience. Yeah. As he's quote unquote alone, first thing he does is turn to the camera and say, oh good, it's just us now. You know, like he knows he's still doing a performance. And then he then sings his parting questionnaire, if you will. And it's a song that doesn't really have, I don't know, it kind of bounces around. And like, I love the line, on a scale from 1 to 2 now, are you happy? But I couldn't explain to you why I love it. There's just something about it that works. And we're getting this, again, one shot with the camera. Like this whole thing happens in one take. The camera pushes in a little bit on the piano, moves around. It's pretty simple, but it's still, you know, one to show us that this is a live recorded performance, you know. But yeah. He finishes the song. The last line he says is, you're everything you hated, are you happy? Hey Ma, I made it, are you happy? And then the camera's back to where it was, where we just sort of see him from behind at his piano. And then he walks away from the camera, right? This is the first point in the special where the camera doesn't follow him. When he wakes up, camera's on him. Camera follows him through the city as he's going to the theater. Obviously on him the whole time he's on stage. Comes off the stage with him. And then this is the last time, he walks away from the camera and the camera doesn't follow him. And I would assume, given the dedication in the credits, it says for Loreen and Bruce. Loreen Scarafia is his partner and is a filmmaker. She most recently directed Hustlers. She is also short. So I believe that is Loreen Scarafia in that shot. And I think the idea is that he's walking away from the camera. He's walking away from any sort of audience. And he's walking away from performance as a concept because he's going to hang out with the one person and one dog who he doesn't have to perform for at all. And they go into the house and he's off camera. And it's like the only time he's off camera in this whole special. And I think that's it. And I think that's why the music builds to become sort of a more full song as he leaves the audience, right? Like he's playing the piano by himself, but that same song continues as he walks away and we get these more instruments and we get sort of this synth element as we get the end credits. And it's just a really nice piece of music, but the whole idea is that it's signifying Bo Burnham walking away from us, you know? And I think that's the happy ending of this special. And I think it is a happy ending, you know?
He doesn't have to live his life with an audience anymore.
Exactly. He goes into the house and writes Eighth Grade.
Yeah. Well, just like Bo Burnham, you threw us the curveball. You said there'd be no winger speech.
I know, hypocrisy's everywhere. But yeah, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and check back next time.